Now you're going to get to know a man who played a pivotal role in the contentious history between the U.S. government and Native people in that part of the country. George Custer was complicated. Pulitzer Prize-winning author T.J. Stiles describes Custer as a buckskin-clad outdoorsman and Indian fighter, urbane theater lover, loving brother and son, and avowed white supremacist. Stiles' book is called Custer's Trials, A Life on the Frontier of a New America. I asked him why he wanted to learn more about George Custer and why contemporary America has to learn from him.
In a historical sense, I wanted to know more about him because, again, of these contradictions and because of the ways in which he reflects the way America came to be the way it is now, and both those people who helped push that process forward and those who resisted, and both sides of that, pushing things forward and also resisting, continue to this day. And Custer actually played a role in both sides, helping to change America and also resisting some of those changes.
Change and resistance. Boy, we still live that every day, don't we?
Yeah, there's a figure who I believe ran for president who had the slogan, Making America Great Again. I forget his name, but anyway.
I've heard.
Yeah. This is the theme, actually, of Custer's life in a way, because he was someone who became a brigadier general thanks to both merit and connections at the age of 23 during the Civil War. But he was catapulted into this combat role at the moment of greatest peril for the United States ever. And actually at one of the decisive moments on the eve of the Battle of Gettysburg. So he became a boy general, as he was called, on the eve of one of the most consequential battles in American history, and he performed exceptionally well. There's no way around it. He wasn't just lucky. He wasn't just brave. He was actually a very capable and inspirational and charismatic combat leader. And for that reason, he was beloved by his men. He was someone who became a national hero. But there was another aspect to him, which that later on flowed into such areas as politics, which is the fact that he represented an earlier America that was being challenged by the Civil War and then by the other changes that followed along with it. He was a romantic figure. He was an individualist. He cultivated this chivalric air, the air of gallantry, with his elaborate custom uniform that he made for himself, with his long flowing hair, with his devil-may-care style. He deliberately crafted an image, and that image was of a more romantic, earlier America that people felt was slipping away in the mass warfare and in the organizational future that the Civil War brought in.
You say he was heroic, he was villainous. I think of George Custer, I think that history has decided he was more of a villain. Maybe it's because I'm in one of those liberal bubbles. But how was he heroic besides his, was it just his Civil War success?
Yeah, that's the main thing in terms of his heroism, in terms of his accomplishments that are, I think, across the board people would consider constructive accomplishments. He was from a border state culture. He's from southern Ohio, from a Maryland-born father. He was a Democrat who had more southern affinities than northern. When it came to politics, he was a loyal, you know, citizen of the United States, a loyal army officer. He believed in the Union, a very kind of border state attitude. But he accepted slavery. Ironically, he helped to destroy slavery. And he even used it as a talking point when he was trying to curry favor with radical Republican politicians. He claimed at one point to have freed more slaves than any other general in the army. It's not true, but he certainly helped many, many enslaved people find freedom. But what happened is, as the war ended, Custer confronted a personal crisis that was also a national crisis. Now that we've won the war and we've destroyed slavery, what does that mean? What kind of nation do we want to come out of this?
Well, you write about how Andrew Johnson, who became president after Lincoln's assassination, fought with Congress over the shape of Reconstruction. Johnson was against any civil rights protections for freed slaves, and Custer supported Johnson on that.
Exactly right. Custer goes on tour with Andrew Johnson. As a serving regular Army officer, he's giving political speeches. He's openly supporting Andrew Johnson. He was a delegate to Johnson's political convention. And as a result, he went from being a great national hero as a result of his Civil War leadership to becoming intensely controversial, and he was seen in a very partisan way. Democrats who favored white supremacy openly backed him. Republicans weren't all racial egalitarians, but it was very much a kind of framed in terms of an extension of the Civil War, and they saw Custer as a traitor. And so when he went west and he started to have troubles in the West, it's the politics that have made him controversial first. It is the fact that he's thrown himself into the doorway to try to stop the constitutional foundations of the America that we have today, one in which there's racially neutral citizenship, in which there are federal protections for the individual for their civil rights. These are all new things that Custer opposes.
So when you hear about the Donald Trump election and this debate over what place white nationalism has in America, are you thinking about George Custer?
Yeah, it's not that. I mean, again, you know, there's two things we have to do. One is we can't make simple equations, because Custer is a product of the 1850s and 1860s. You know, he increasingly makes a point of intervening in politics as an army officer and on the side of white supremacy. Now we come 150 years later to an America in which the, you know, political civility, political standards have been such that, you know, we both parties have at least, you know, at least in terms of rhetoric, embraced the idea of America being a place open to all. And along comes Donald Trump, who talks in explicitly racial terms. Even Paul Ryan said that Donald Trump's comment about the judge hearing the Trump University fraud case, even Paul Ryan says that's pretty much the definition, textbook definition of racism.
This is the judge born in Indiana but with Mexican ancestry.
That's exactly right. And so this is really startling. Now, the existence of those kinds of tensions, the kind of them versus us tensions, the America first, as Trump puts it, you know, these, of course, you know, in a nation that had slavery, this goes back, you know, to before the founding of the Republic. You know, at the moment when civil rights are being invented, that's when you have kind of the formation of, you know, forms of racism and an argument for a racial identity as an American identity takes place kind of in opposition to it. They're kind of intertwined, in not that racism was born because of civil rights, but the specific way in which people responded to it.
Let's talk about another past-present echo. George Custer's most famous battle, I suppose, is his last stand in eastern Montana Territory. What he was fighting, some of the part of the same tribe that is now fighting against this proposed Dakota Access Pipeline.
And there's some interesting things to draw out about this, which is that the people who are really on the side of expanding the idea of American identity and of civil rights in the South, when they come west, their idea is we are going to integrate Native people into the United States and make them citizens. So that's actually explicitly destructive of their sovereignty, autonomy, and cultural distinctiveness. Their religious distinctiveness, their languages, their everything that makes them their own people and their own nations. So the same Congress that passed the Ku Klux Klan Act in 1871, putting the federal government in charge of enforcing voting rights for the first time and protecting individuals from terrorist groups attacking people's right to vote, that same Congress passed a law saying no more treaties with Indian nations. We're not going to treat them as sovereign entities anymore. And so when you look at the roots, this is not to get, you know, delve into all the details of the Standing Rock dispute, but it ultimately comes down to the fact that that again and again, Native nations have not been the sense of them being sovereign entities has not been respected, and that the United States has kind of gone back and forth, and there's been, you know, neglect even during some of the least oppressive periods, that this idea that they are their own people. And as individuals, they have every right to be, you know, as integrate themselves as fully into the rest of the nation as they want to. But as a group, they deserve respect as sovereign people. And this is really, I think, the root of the crisis that's happening right now at Standing Rock. Myself, that's my own view.
Will you say a little more about that? How is that root playing into the headlines our listeners are seeing?
Well, let's take the fact that in this kind of smallest way, the most detailed way. One of the big complaints is that there are insufficient consultations. And, you know, there were some contacts. There might have been some messages sent. But the idea that they had to really be taken seriously,
that the pipeline building company didn't consult enough with
them. Yeah, and that the Army Corps of Engineers didn't really consult with them. And they don't feel like they've been engaged. And there are people on the other side saying, well, we tried, et cetera. But you have to put it in this context of how the treatment of Indians has been unilateral. There's a way in which the sort of sense of environmental threat and degradation, there's crossed wires. And that's been true from the very beginning in the dealings of the U.S. with Native people. And I think, again, that's a part of the historical context in which this environmental conflict is taking place.
So we come back to the man at the center of so many of these stories and at the center of your book, Custer's Trials. In the preface of your book, you said that you wanted, quote, to examine Custer's life as it was lived in order to better grasp the man, his times, and his larger meaning. So you've made that examination. What is George Custer's larger meaning to you?
Well, I think that Custer really reflects a number of different things that are really worth thinking about. You know, why was it that millions of Americans resisted civil rights? Well, you see it in this one life. So here's a human being who, even at his most, most exasperating self, is a vivid human being we can really recognize and understand, and he's facing an America that's undergoing huge changes. So how is it that people deal with times of great change? How is it that people deal with a world in which the individual seems to be diminished by organizations and government and these larger things that seem to overshadow our lives? And Custer responded to changes and to a sense of threat to the world in which he'd come of age in ways that I think we can really understand, even if we can't accept the ways in which he reacted in many ways. And it's an amazing American story that I think really has resonance for today.
T.J. Stiles, author of the book Custer's Trials, A Life on the Frontier of a New America, which won this year's Pulitzer Prize for History.